The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to Too Jewish with Rabbi Sam Kohan and Friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Stephen Fried, author of the book, The New Rabbi. We'll also visit with our maven on Israel, Danny Bobman, and our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please contact us with comments at our email address, TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com. Too Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a Reformed Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Southern Arizona's fastest-growing synagogue, the only full-service Reformed congregation in Southern Arizona. We're sponsored as well by Jill Rich of Realty Executives, by Environmental Strategies, and by Better Bodies. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. I hope you've all enjoyed a splendid Thanksgiving weekend filled with food, family, and relaxation. Giving thanks is an important part of Jewish life, an important part of all religious life, really, perhaps all human life, and the ability to do so in freedom and contentment is a crucial aspect of being American. That and watching football, of course. One of the great elements of the American dream is the need to go out and explore new worlds, to conquer the unknown, to boldly go where no man has gone before, or at least experience new worlds. Thanksgiving celebrates that, a small group of believers who left everything they had known behind and headed out into the unknown. It's a courageous motivation that's shaped American character throughout our history. But that urge has also been a fundamental Jewish motivation for far longer, since the dawn of time, or at least since the genesis of Judaism, thousands of years ago. We meet it in the life of the very first Jew, Abraham, who leaves home and comfort to follow a dream of divine blessing and favor in a new promised land. And we encounter it again, most powerfully, in the story of this week's great Torah portion of Vayetze. At the start of the tale, Jacob leaves his family and home, both of which happened to be in Beersheba at the time, and journeys towards Sumeria, today's Iraq, ironically enough. He has nothing with him at all, not even a bedroll, and is forced to lay his head on a rock to sleep. And in this state of extremis, God brings him a promise in the form of a famous dream, a ladder going up to heaven with angels ascending and descending, and a promise of family and land and ultimate safety and security. Jacob, our forefather, wakes from this dream and says pointedly, "Hey, God was in this place, and I didn't know it." Now that's something all of us can say from time to time, isn't it? Somehow it takes Jacob leaving everything familiar to allow him to find God's presence. Of all the heroic figures in our people's past, Jacob is the most interesting, I think. He's complex, clever, unreliable, resourceful, and he has a rather spectacular love life, all of which takes off in this week's Torah portion. But it's that first moment when he realizes how little he really knows that makes him most human and most like us today. We too struggle to find out where we can find God. Of course, sometimes the words themselves are hard to understand. Here's a little tune we play from time to time about the difficulty of seeking God in today's world. So unlike the world of our father Jacob, and yet in this one respect, very similar. It's called the Prayer Book Blues, from my father and my CD, Generation to Generation.
Am I supposed to sit or stand in the synagogue blues? My folks sent me the cheder when I was just a child, but instead of learning all of face, I was out there running wild. I've got the what page are we on in the prayer book blues? And the guy right next to me is taking a snooze. I don't know what I'm reading, I don't know what to speak. God spoke to us in Hebrew, but to me the thing is Greek. see in the synagogue blues. So it's Cheder for you young men, and learn your Olivet face. Don't you dare take after me with egg all on your face. Am I supposed to sit or stand in the synagogue blues? Well, I guess I'll see you later, 'cause I'm going back to Cheder. I've got the what page are we on in the prayer book blues? 98.
You got the wrong book there, Baruch.
No, it's not. See, it says right here on the cover, 613 ways to prepare potato latkes.
I've got the what page are we on in the prayer book blues. I've got the what page are we on in the prayer book blues.
The prayer book blues. God spoke to us in Hebrew, but to me the thing is Greek. But we can learn from it nonetheless. When we come back, we'll meet our guest, author Stephen Fried, who wrote the terrific book, The New Rabbi.
The greatest Hanukkah on earth is coming to Temple Emmanuel Sunday, December 14th at 4:30 p.m. Join Temple Emmanuel for the largest, most spectacular, and most enjoyable Hanukkah celebration of all, featuring a wonderful array of music, theater, dance, stories, and magic. Hanukkah comes to life at the Temple's 5th Annual Festival of Lights. Sing and celebrate Hanukkah with us. Begin by helping light the giant outdoor menorah on Country Club Road at 4:30 p.m. and then rejoice with the Avanim Rock Band, Temple Emmanuel Youth and Teen Choir, our string quartet, Rabbi Sam Cohen and David Freeland, and an array of great performers. Bring a menorah and two candles as we light up the night in a gorgeous finale that'll make this your most memorable Hanukkah ever. This Hanukkah event is open to all, and there's no charge for the show. Come join the fun at the temple. If you want to join us for a great traditional brisket and latke dinner afterwards, call the temple at 327-4501 and make a reservation with your credit card. Sunday, December 14th, beginning at 4:30 p.m., it's the greatest Hanukkah on earth at Temple Emmanuel.
We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish author Stephen Fried. He is an award-winning investigative journalist and essayist, the author of three books. His first book, Thing of Beauty, about the Gia Carangi story, was an international cult favorite. Bitter Pills, his second book, was required reading at the FDA about the legal drug culture encouraged in this country. And his most recent book, perhaps most interesting to us, The New Rabbi, was published just last year from Bantam and explores the lives of the clergy of an important synagogue in Philadelphia in its search for a replacement for a legendary rabbi. Welcome to Two Jewish, Stephen Fried.
Thanks for having me.
How did you decide that you wanted to write a book about Har Zion's search for a new rabbi?
The idea of writing a book about a synagogue and using a rabbi search as sort of the dramatic spine for it was one that I had actually about 10 years ago. But I, at that point, was not all that observant myself, and it seemed like something, it was not really time for me to do yet.
I think you said you were a six-day-a-year Jew?
Yeah, I mean, I did the High Holidays and Passover and Hanukkah, so I figured I was twice as good as a three-day-a-year Jew. And basically what happened in 1997, my father died. He was 62 years old. And much to my own astonishment, I mourned him completely traditionally. I went to Minyan every day for a year and found myself going to synagogue every day, which was a revelation in lots of ways. One, because I didn't really know what I was doing that well. But two, because the culture of the synagogue seemed very fascinating to me, and I started thinking about this book idea again. And then, you know, totally coincidentally, Rabbi Gerald Wolpe, who had been my rabbi when I was a little kid and who had been stolen from my synagogue in Harrisburg when I was 11 because he got a better job, which was the first time that I and my community ever learned about careerism in the clergy, and had gone to Har Zion, which is one of the biggest, most powerful synagogues in the country. He announced his retirement after 30 years on that pulpit. And I went to him and I told him about this idea that I had, and I asked him if he would participate and he would help me to, make inroads with the other people of the synagogue, and he thought it was an interesting idea. He's a very generous man with his time and his intellect, and that's really how the process began. I started doing sort of Tuesdays with Maury-ish interviews with him, just about the real life of a rabbi. And then at a certain point, I started covering the synagogue. I started going to synagogue, going to services on Shabbos, really sort of looking for not only to pray, but also to meet people who were trying to figure out who was who in the synagogue.
And that ultimately became a very interesting and controversial exploration. We will talk much more with author Stephen Fried, the author of The New Rabbi, a little later this morning on Too Jewish.
Environmental Strategies Incorporated was established in Arizona almost 15 years ago. They're a corporation that's very unique and has distinguished itself as one of the foremost environmental remediation companies in Arizona. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is also a full-service general contractor. The fact that they have two divisions affords their clients the opportunity to work with one contractor to deal with environmental problems as well as their building and remodeling needs. Environmental Strategies clientele range from single-family homeowners to multi-million-dollar Fortune 500 companies. So, if you're in need of asbestos abatement, mold remediation, or general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies at 884-1114. And if you wish, ask for Ken Goodman, the president. He'd be more than happy to talk with you about your project. That's Environmental Strategies, 884-1114.
When I started working out with Jeremy, I weighed 137 pounds and I had 29% body fat.
Barb talks about her experience with personal trainer Jeremy Price of Better Bodies.
After 12 weeks, I weighed 117 pounds and had 14% body fat. My energy level skyrocketed.
In their new private facility, Better Bodies makes it easy to lose your body fat fast.
Physically, I feel better than I have in my whole life, and my family and friends and everyone around me sees a big difference.
After just 6 weeks, Better Bodies promises you a better body, and individual programs start at only $39.99 a month.
At Better Bodies, it's a great atmosphere and positive and energetic and encouraging.
For a free personal evaluation, call Better Bodies at 975-7074.
You will definitely see results.
That's 975-7074 or on the web at betterbodiestucson.com.
You know, it's slightly hard to believe that Hanukkah is coming up soon, but with Thanksgiving done, it's the next holiday of consequence on the ritual radar. We'll feature some Hanukkah music each week as we build up to the Festival of Lights. Our own celebration, the greatest Hanukkah on earth at Temple Emmanuel, is just 2 weeks away, December 14th. So it's appropriate to begin to get in the mood. Here's a lovely early Hanukkah melody from Sephardic artist Flori Jagoda of Yugoslavia, back when there was a Yugoslavia. In Ladino, ocho candelicas, 8 nights of Hanukkah with matchmaking parties every night, singing, dancing, and little almond cakes to eat, by the group The Voice of the Turtle.
Hanukkah linda está aquí, ocho candelas para mí. Hanukkah linda está aquí, ocho candelas para mí. Oh.
Una candelica, dos candelicas, tres candelicas, cuatro candelicas, cinco candelicas, seis candelicas, siete candelicas, ocho candelas para mí.
Muchas fiestas voy a hacer con alegría y placer. Muchas fiestas voy a hacer con alegría y placer.
Una candelica, dos candelicas, tres candelicas, cuatro candelicas, cinco candelicas, seis candelicas, siete candelicas, ocho candelas para mí.
Los pastelicos voy a comer con almendricas y la miel. Los pastelicos voy a comer con almendricas y la miel.
Candelica, dos candelicas, tres candelicas, cuatro candelicas, cinco candelicas, seis candelicas, siete candelicas, ocho candelas para mí.
Ocho candelicas, 8 nights of Hanukkah from The Voice of the Turtle. And now it's time for an increasingly popular feature of Two Jewish, our old joke of the week. We are so, so pleased to bring you now our old joke of the week. Humor your Bubby and Zadie knew. Morty and Abe, who are not very religious men, are walking their dogs by the temple on Saturday morning. Morty suggests, "Let's go in. I hear they have great chopped liver at the Kiddush every Shabbos." Abe answers, "They'll never let us go in with dogs." So Morty says, "Just follow my lead." And into the temple he goes. The shamus, that's a kind of caretaker doorkeeper, stops him and says, "No dogs allowed in the shul." And Morty answers, "It's my seeing eye dog." And the shamus says, "Oh, okay, go on in." Abe follows him, and again the shamus says, "No dogs allowed in the shul." And Abe answers, "It's my seeing eye dog." And the shamus says, "This is your seeing eye dog? A chihuahua?" And Abe says, "Is that what they gave me?" That's the old joke of the week. Humor your Bubby and Zadie knew. A special feature of Two Jewish, brought to you as a public service. When we return, we'll have a Zen Judaism update and enjoy our Jewish poetry slam.
Every once in a while, you want a different sort of day. A day you can be transported in a comfortable coach bus, partake in a wonderful luncheon, and see a show you'll truly enjoy, like Showboat. Min will take you on a journey of pure delight. For entertainment trips to Mesa, Globe, and elsewhere, call Min at 296-1190. The delightful musical Showboat will be performed on the 25th of February in Mesa, Arizona. It's $60 for the whole experience, including the bus, the meal, and the show. Call Min at 296-1190. Ask about their Apache Gold overnight trip, too. It's to enjoy. Call Min at 296-1190.
If you have questions, comments, or criticism, send it all to us at TwoJewishRadio@yahoo.com. We promise to write back. You can now get CDs of any past Two Jewish shows for a nominal fee by calling Temple Emmanuel at 327-4501 or on the web at TempleEmmanuelTucson.org. We're pleased and serene now to welcome back a recurring feature of Two Jewish, Zen Judaism. Seek out all true dharmas. Pursue all stuffed dharmas. Practice loving kindness with all other sentient beings. Still, would it kill you to find a sentient being who is Jewish? And finally, what use is profit? Can accumulating money day after day in trade or business truly bring satisfaction? Of course not. For that, one must go shopping. That was our Zen Judaism update. Our Jewish poetry slam this morning comes from poet Ruth Brin on our Torah portion of Vayetze. The angels going up and down on the golden ladder did not change Jacob's destination, nor did the promises of God establish his manhood. But after many years, when he had won Rachel, when he was a bearded man, a master of tents and flocks, it's written that Jacob dreamed again. This time he called together his family to go meet the brother he had wronged, to turn again to the land and God of his fathers. Maturity may come with work and wisdom with years, but let us always remember the dream and the vision that are the gifts of God. We pray that the glitter of all the wealth we have worked to possess will not blind our eyes to our own inner vision. We pray for dreams in the years of our strength, and for strength in the days of our dreams. Ruth Brin's poem, Jacob's Dream, on Parshat Vayetze. When we come back, we'll talk to Danny Bobman, our maven on Israel, and get the news of Jews around the world.
At Temple Emmanuel Preschool, they really have fun.
Aleph, Bet, Vet.
Aleph, Bet, Vet.
Gimel, Dalet, Hey.
Gimel, Dalet, Hey.
at Temple Emmanuel Preschool.
Temple Emmanuel Preschool.
We learn and play all day.
We learn and play all day.
At Temple Emmanuel Preschool, children are welcome from 6 weeks to pre-kindergarten. We've got small class sizes with a low student-to-teacher ratio. Our professional staff is highly trained and nurturing, and the school offers an all-day extended program with a rich learning curriculum including science, art, music, and dance. Of course, Temple Emmanuel Preschool is open to community members of all faiths. We invite you to come for a visit anytime. Just call Lynn or Melissa at 325-0390. Remember, at Temple Emmanuel Preschool,
we learn and play all day.
Temple Emmanuel Preschool on Country Club just north of Broadway. Call 325-0390 or go to templeemmanueltucson.org. So, here you are, enjoying your Sunday morning with Rabbi Sam Kohan, his mavens, and his friends. Isn't it great hearing the variety of in-depth interviews, the traditional and not-so-traditional Jewish music, the news of Jews around the world, and of course the wit and humor that you've come to expect? You know, producing Too Jewish is a labor of love, but we do need your help. We'd like to ask your business to consider advertising right here within our show. By advertising here, you'll reach an educated, affluent audience, an audience that's loyal. It's easy and inexpensive to advertise on Too Jewish. Just call 327-4501. Your call will help guarantee that Too Jewish remains a source for the best of Jewish culture. Please call today, 327-4501. 327-4501. And thanks from your friends right here at Too Jewish.
Danny Bobman, our maven on Israel, is here to talk about, well, labor and strikes in Israel. Boker Tov, Danny, and welcome.
Good morning, Rabbi. First of all, I wanted to congratulate our General Assembly delegate on their safe return to Tucson. You know, for a while, there was a concern that with all the strikes that are going on in Israel, their travel plans will have to alter. But in the end, it all went well, and they are back. Speaking of strikes, let me explain a little about all that. Labor unions are a very important part of Israel's history. They existed long before the state was founded. They started when groups of pioneers got organized to make their stands against the landlords and farmers who employed them in the fields of Palestine. The pioneers of the Second Aliyah were socialists who believed in equality and egalitarianism. Although they knew they needed to behave themselves in order to get the jobs that will grant them survival in Eretz Israel, they made their point by creating worker unions. This umbrella organization for these unions, the Histadrut, was once the strongest body in Israel, and you could not be elected and many times get a job without strong affiliation to it. Today, there are still 76 labor unions under the Histadrut. The strongest of them are the state, electricity, water, telephone, teachers, and port authority workers. As Israel is a democracy, they all have the right to strike after they give an advance warning to their employers. These days, most of the strikes and the strike threats revolve around two things. One, wages, the constant dispute. These days, it's not so much about the salaries base, but rather on government compensation for price hikes in the past month. Second, privatization. In the past 10 years, most union-based companies were privatized and no longer adhere to union agreements. Workers in still unionized companies, as mentioned above, are afraid to lose all their achievements from the past 60 years. And while they understand that in modern markets and economy, union agreements can cost their companies their livelihood, they still want to ensure permanent positions, seniority, and pension plans to their union members. Israelis are well rehearsed in this ritual of strikes, but as the economy is so slow, the union struggle is not always perceived favorably. With the exception of teachers, past strikes and battles left the workers of organizations mentioned earlier with some of the most lucrative salaries and benefits in the country. Not all Israelis identify with their struggle, and frankly, a lot are citing the government plans to privatize them all for the sake of better cost and service. So you see, Rabbi, it's a rather complicated matter, and I'm glad that our distinguished delegates did not get caught in the middle of all of it. Have a good weekend. Shavuot Tov.
Shavuot Tov, Danny. Thanks. We'll talk next week. When we return, we'll talk with Tom Price about the international Jewish scene in Turkey in particular and get the news of Jews around the world.
If you're like most people, your biggest purchase is your home. Don't you wish there was someone you could turn to who not only had knowledge and experience, but who truly cared about you? If you're looking to buy or sell a home, you need to know Jill Rich. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. With over 20 years of experience, Jill's one of Tucson's top realtors. She specializes in all kinds of residential property. She can find you a starter house or a castle. Jill will find you the perfect home. While the stock market has wild gyrations, real estate grows in value. If you want to invest in income property, Jill can guide you. And if you're thinking about selling your home, Jill provides a personal marketing program to sell your house fast. You can reach Jill Rich at Realty Executives River Road Office, 615-8400. Jill provides strong representation in a caring way. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. Jill Rich, call 615-8400.
Welcome, Tom Price, our authority on the international Jewish scene and the international scene. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Last week we spoke about Turkey and the bombings there, and now you're going to talk about some related aspect tied in with international terrorism and al-Qaeda.
Right. I think that apart from the specific targets of the recent bombings in Turkey, Turkey is seen in the Arab world correctly as being a Western country and as being closely allied with Western interests. It is pretty fiercely secular, although it's a functioning democracy. So recently, for example, an Islamist party gained a certain percentage of seats in parliament, and the Islamists have long controlled the city hall in Istanbul. But there are constitutional checks and balances which keep Turkey rigidly secular. And obviously, Arabs who want fundamentalist Quranic law to be the law of the land are not happy with that. But I think more broadly, we have a phenomenon of seeing al-Qaeda and other Islamic terrorist organizations simply shifting their theater of attack to attack not only the U.S., but also its allies. And if, incidentally, as has been the case in every one of these incidents, including 9/11, lots of Muslims are killed, too bad. They were in the wrong place at the wrong time, as far as these terrorists see it. I think the real question is, how are we doing in our war on terrorism? I mean, okay, we got rid of the Taliban in Afghanistan. Does anyone talk about Afghanistan now? If you do look closely at Afghanistan, the results are pretty sad. We have a huge military presence, including ongoing U.S. casualties in Afghanistan. We're spending a lot of money, but probably not enough. But the result is that many Afghans, men, women, and children, are still living in terror. They're still ruled by warlords who would, if they could, drag them back to the 15th century. And the situation has gotten appreciably better only in two or three of the largest cities. In the rest of the country, I don't think people are much better off than before we launched this war on terrorism, and I don't think that Western interests are much safer. All right, you may ask then, what about the war in Iraq? Wasn't that supposed to make us safer? Well, as the president himself has belatedly admitted, there was never any connection established between Saddam Hussein and 9/11 or between Iraq and al-Qaeda. And what we're doing in Iraq may make Iraq a better place for Iraqis, but it's not clear that it makes the world safer from international terrorism.
Thanks, Tom. We wish it were safer from international terrorism, but not yet. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
Shavuot Tov.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Last week, a Turkish court charged nine suspected accomplices in last week's Istanbul suicide bombings. Charges came just 5 days after the bombings of the British consulate and a London-based bank in Istanbul. 57 people died in those attacks in Turkey and in the earlier bombings of two important synagogues in the city. At the arraignment, a police line held back a crowd of shouting relatives, including several women wearing black chadors, the all-covering Islamic garment, rare in downtown Istanbul. Authorities also arrested six more people in connection with the synagogue bombings. Court charged five with attempting to overthrow the constitutional structure, which carries a life sentence. A sixth was charged with helping illegal organizations, punishable by 5 years in prison. Istanbul Governor Muammer Guler said authorities were making progress in the investigation and had used DNA samples to identify the man who rammed an explosive-packed pickup truck into the consulate. "We've identified the culprits who carried out the attack on the British consulate," Guler said. "We have all the details and we know their connections." The Istanbul newspaper Milliyet defied government reporting restrictions and identified the murderer as Feridun Urgulu, a Turk believed to have fought with Islamic radicals in Afghanistan and Chechnya. Turkish media said both bombers in Thursday's attacks were terrorists previously reported to be accomplices of the suicide bombers in the November 16th attacks on two Istanbul synagogues. Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan, in a televised national address on the eve of Eid al-Fitr, the religious holiday ending the Muslim fast month of Ramadan, appealed to Turks to resist terrorism. "This is a war between justice and cruelty, good and bad, and true and false. It is our right to expect every sensible person to stand by justice, good, and truth in this war," Erdogan said. Police are examining the hard drives of 10 computers taken after the synagogue bombings from an internet cafe in the city of Bingöl, Turkey. Who would have thought it? The cafe belonged to the brother of one of the suspected bombers. On Sunday, Erdogan said it was too early to confirm al-Qaeda involvement, but foreign and Turkish officials say the attacks bore the hallmarks of the network led by Osama bin Laden still. In other news, Palestinian Prime Minister Ahmed Kureya urged Prime Minister Ariel Sharon of Israel to take serious and significant steps to renew the dialogue between Israel and the Palestinians. Meanwhile, Palestinian Authority Chairman Yasser Arafat said late Monday that Israeli hints of unilateral moves showed that Sharon was not serious about the U.S.-backed roadmap to peace. Sharon himself repeated his earlier statements that he has become convinced there is no reason to wait for a new Palestinian government and that he is not rejecting unilateral steps, not as concessions, but for the good of the state of Israel. But Arafat said such steps were against the roadmap, quote-unquote. "They are following this plan to escape the implementation of the roadmap," said Arafat, adding that United Nations forces or at least observers should come to the region. "This means they don't want to make peace," he said, as though Arafat did, or as though Arafat had followed any step of the roadmap till now. In a dog bites man story, the Israeli Secret Service Shin Bet's chief reported to the Sunday Knesset cabinet meeting last week that Yasser Arafat continues to fund terror out of the Palestinian Authority budget, which is partly subsidized by the West. He said Hamas leaders spend about 90% of their time in hiding these days and 10% preparing strikes against Israel. Nobody knows how he came up with that estimate. In the meantime, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon set up a senior ministerial panel for preliminary talks with Palestinians prior to meeting with Palestinian Prime Minister Kureya. Before talking to Israel, Palestinians are said to be seeking their own internal truce between Hamas and the various elements of Fatah. Simultaneously, the Bush administration has sent new signals to Sharon demanding the government stop expanding settlements and stop the construction of the barrier fence in the West Bank. The administration's concern was conveyed last week in a meeting in Rome, a secret one, between Sharon and White House top Middle East advisor Elliot Abrams. Not as secret as all that. In another step, Dov Weissglass, Sharon's chief of staff, met with senior American officials at the White House to discuss the administration's plan to reduce the amount of loan guarantees to Israel in response to Israeli spending on West Bank settlements and the security fence. And in South America, Marxist rebels in Colombia released two European hostages from Germany and Spain and promised to free four Israelis and a Briton before the year's end. The National Liberation Army of Colombia that held the two men, a 5,000-strong Cuban-inspired group known by its Spanish acronym ELN, still holds four Israelis, Benny Daniel, Ido Guy, Erez Atawil, and Orpaz Ohayon, and an English tourist, Mark Henderson, whom they seized at Jungle Ruins September 12th. In Europe, the recent bombings of synagogues in Turkey and an attack on a Jewish school in France appear to have jolted European leaders into action against anti-Semitism at long last. After a Jewish day school near Paris burned down last week, French President Jacques Chirac announced the creation of a special interministerial entity to deal with anti-Semitic incidents. Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi told a delegation of the European Jewish Congress this week that he would call on his counterparts to take up the issue at an upcoming European summit next month. In addition, Romano Prodi, head of the European Commission, the executive arm of the European Union, has agreed to hold a seminar in the next few weeks on how to confront anti-Semitism in Europe. Best of luck to all of those involved with this new direction. Late last week, a fire destroyed a Terry Haught museum dedicated to the Holocaust, and arson is suspected with reason. "Remember Timmy McVeigh" was scrawled on a wall of the Candles Museum, which houses artifacts or housed artifacts from Auschwitz and documents relating to the evil Dr. Joseph Mengele. McVeigh, the Oklahoma City bomber, was executed at a federal prison outside Terry Haught in 2001. Survivors of the Holocaust and community leaders vow to rebuild the museum. Finally, in New York, Edgar Bronfman Jr. and a group of investors have announced an agreement to buy Warner Music, home to Madonna and REM, among many others, from Time Warner for $2.6 billion. Bronfman, current leader of the billionaire Jewish family, is expected to contribute about $250 million to the deal, buying himself a chance to repair his very damaged fiscal reputation. 3 years ago, Bronfman sold his family's Seagram's liquor empire for shares of Vivendi, a French utility-turned-media company, only to watch it nearly collapse and take with it the family's huge fortune, or much of it. The deal for Time Warner's music arm will leave Edgar Bronfman, a one-time songwriter for Celine Dion, as the company's top executive, and give him a chance at financial redemption, not to mention the opportunity to be Madonna, that noted Kabbalist's boss. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish author Stephen Fried. He is the author, most recently, of The New Rabbi, a terrific book about Temple Har Zion of Philadelphia's quest for a new spiritual leader. It's just out in paperback now. He's also the author of Thing of Beauty, an international cult favorite on the Gia Carangi story, Bitter Pills about the pharmaceutical industry, and in many magazine articles, including ones for Vanity Fair, GQ, Glamour, has been a regular contributor to the Washington Post magazine and Rolling Stone, two-time winner of the National Magazine Award. He teaches journalism at Columbia, and he is a marvelous writer. Welcome back, Stephen Fried.
Thanks very much.
Stephen, when you began to explore Temple Har Zion, you were given tremendous access to the inner workings of both the search committee, Rabbi Wolpe, as you mentioned, who was retiring after many years of prominent success in the rabbinate. Why were you given so much access?
Well, I think given might be a misnomer. I got access to the community over a long period of time, and I followed life at the synagogue for 4 years. The search committee initially turned me down, and basically I was able to develop, the way that any journalist does, just by asking a lot of questions, I was able to develop sources on the search committee. I was able to develop other sources in the clergy. And, I tried not to, people talked to me privately, so I didn't want to make it, whoever was talking to me was talking to me. And, most of them did it on the record and very openly. But during this time, you have to understand, think about in your own synagogue, if there was a journalist there who was watching in real time a very political and sort of angst-ridden process, which, picking a new rabbi is hard, even when it goes well. So I sometimes knew things that other people didn't know. I was sometimes the only person that certain people were speaking to when they weren't speaking to each other. But it was a hard one thing. The book reads like, because that's the way I wanted it to read, that I knew everything every second as it was happening. But in fact, I learned a lot of things over the course of 4 years. And, people felt that I was this unusual mix of, I was a well-known investigative reporter, especially in Philadelphia, and I was obviously somebody who was very interested in exploring his Judaism. So, of course it's an unusual request to have somebody come in and ask for this kind of access, but I think they felt that I was going to do something valuable with it, and I felt that way too.
I'm reminded of Tracy Kidder's book, instead of Soul of a New Machine, it's sort of a soul of a congregation.
Yeah, that's very much the kind of journalism that I wanted to do. There has been very little writing in American journalism about congregational life of any religion. And I think that congregational life is incredibly important. And certainly during the time that I was mourning, I never had been more reliant on congregational life. I don't have to tell you, when you're sitting there waiting for the 10th person for Minyan, you are, completely, waiting for the community to be there for you. So it seemed like, and I wrote a lot about my own personal experiences besides following what was happening at Har Zion. It was really, the goal was to write a book that was part memoir and part sort of social history and that read really great.
You wrote about the search in very intimate detail, including some of the rabbis who sought the position and were rejected.
Yes.
I know it was a great deal of controversy about that in the conservative movement.
Yes.
Tell me about that a little bit.
Well, some of the rabbis who interviewed for the job and didn't get it, and whose names were known to people within the congregation, and all of whom went on to take other jobs, so it was not a secret that they were looking for jobs, felt that I should not have identified them by name, and felt that the details of their interview with the committee shouldn't have been in my book. I mean, I don't agree, obviously. My interest and my goals were journalistic. And secondly, you know, these are people who are applying for very high-profile jobs at nonprofit institutions. And, you know, within their community, within the communities, people know what's going on in these interviews. So, you know, I think that when it's all said and done, people now, they're critiquing more the people from the search committee told me what was going on. And I think some of them just, you know, they didn't get the job. They weren't happy they didn't get the job. And then maybe they were mad that I, you know, by writing about it, called attention to the fact that they didn't get the job. But, you know, I tried to be very ginger with what I used of that material. I actually took quite a bit of it out. But certain rabbis, and I think some of them just happened to be louder rabbis, made a big stink about it, and there was a front-page story in the Foreword and all this stuff. But the truth is, I mean, I spend an enormous amount of time being invited by rabbis to come speak at their synagogues. So I don't know that the majority of conservative rabbis share this upset. I think that it's just been something that has gotten some prominent attention, and you know, my goal really has been to have conversations with the rabbis who are upset about the book, because I think that by coming out against the book, what they're telling all their congregants and their lay leaders who are reading the book, you know, a lot, and the people are saying, like, why don't you like this book? This book gives me an insight into what you do that I never had before, and then you're telling me there's something wrong with the book. So there's a little bit of a disconnect there. But the controversy is real specific. It's real inside baseball, and it really only involves 5 or 6 pages of the book, because basically, I mean, I've had review. There was a review in the Jerusalem Report, which basically said, like, except for the fact that I identified these handful of rabbis, they would enthusiastically recommend the book.
I think most of the reviews have been very positive, and of course, it's the Jewish publications that have been most controversial about it.
Yeah, I think that some of the questions about journalism on Jews and journalism on rabbis, I think they're interesting questions, and I think that some of the things the rabbis think need to be debated and need to be discussed.
For example,
when I finally get to talk to some of these rabbis, I say, let's have a public conversation about this. If rabbis think that journalism and Judaism are opposites, you know, I think we need to talk.
You watch this process probably as closely as anybody who's not been on a search committee or a rabbi or other professional of a congregation has ever seen it. Do you think it's a healthy process, the choosing of a new rabbi?
Oh yeah, I think that I think it's a very healthy process. I think it's an amazing process that is partly Jewish and partly American. Frankly, it's really, you know, a very democratized version of however rabbis used to end up at synagogues, and it's a fascinating process. It can get unhealthy because it's very demanding. It is an incredibly ambitious thing that a community does, and sometimes they don't rise to the level of ambitiousness that they need to. But I think the process is an amazing one, and because it's not just picking a new rabbi. If it's done correctly, what happens first is the congregation gets back in touch with the fact that it was not started by a rabbi. It was started by them. And in order to pick a good rabbi for their future, they need to reevaluate their own community, because they have to take control of it again. Because if you've had a rabbi for a long time, even if you love that rabbi, people don't feel necessarily they have been controlling the fate of their congregation as much as they had turned it over to their beloved rabbi. So the process of taking back your community yourself in a healthy way, and then hiring a rabbi who supports and will help you execute the goals you have for your future, I think is an incredibly healthy process, but it's not that easy to do.
Do you feel that you could recommend suggestions? You're a journalist, not a judge, and yet, as I said, you've seen this so closely. Suggestions that would make it an easier process for congregations?
Well, I mean, part of what I can do, I think, actually, is for people to be able to read the book, which has been happening a lot. First of all, so they know they're not alone. You know, when a congregation goes through a rabbi search process, they feel like they're the first congregation that ever went through this.
Always.
And all the problems they're having are totally specific to them. And which is true what's happening at Har Zion, too. To have a book, you know, where you can actually read along with what somebody else went through, I think is helpful. And, you know, I've tried to augment that by making myself available for the synagogues that do want to had me come in and actually talk to their search committees and talk to their congregations. But I think that part of the thing is that congregations need to do the whole process. It takes a year. It is a process of self-evaluation and then a personnel search. And what happens a lot of times is that as soon as they start interviewing candidates, all the self-evaluation they did goes out the window. And they're just in a chase for whoever they think is the best candidate for them, just based on criteria that sometimes aren't even the criterion they decided on. So I think that part of it is whether you can stay focused on it and also deal with just the, you know, this is a human process. You only get to pick from the rabbis who apply to your synagogue. And your job can be open in a year where there are many candidates or few candidates, or all the candidates are older or all the candidates are younger. So it is, you know, there are certain parts of it that you cannot predict. But I do think that people, if they understand the context of what they're doing, they can make better choices. And it's hard to understand the context because you're basically asking a community to go through a lot. Communities don't usually evaluate themselves that often, and they don't love change, you know, even though they say they do. So it's, you know, it's a lot to go through. And the other part of it is that it is one of those few opportunities the community has to say, what if we want to make some changes? This is the time to do it. So it's a very ripe time. It's a very pregnant time. And so it's important for people to take into consideration just how much can happen during that year. And, you know, in the case of Har Zion, I didn't expect this book to be a cautionary tale. It turned out to be one. But that certainly wasn't what any of us thought when I started doing the book.
The relationship between a congregation and a rabbi is often described as a shidduch, a marriage. There is a cautionary tale in the book. You want to explain it?
Well, I think that it turns out the book has a lot of cautionary tales. Besides the cautionary tale about the actual rabbi search process itself and how difficult it can be, because in this case a synagogue picked a rabbi, he pulled out at the last minute, they decided to, I'm not going to tell the whole story, but they decided to elevate their young rabbi.
The assistant rabbi who was in his first position, wasn't legally qualified, according to the statute, right?
At a congregation of 1,400 families. They were urged not to do this. They decided to do it anyway. And, you know, a lot of drama ensued. But it's also a cautionary tale for other reasons. I mean, the relationship between the senior rabbi who was retiring and his assistant, I mean, I watched it before my very eyes just sort of deteriorate. It was very difficult to watch. It was like a father and son, you know, whose relationship was going okay, and then in the handoff just sort of got mangled. And so there were a lot of different relationships that I watched change and grow or change and fall apart over the 4 years that I watched the congregation. At the same time, the congregation did grow. And even through their difficulties, I have to say that, you know, while the book reports on some dark times at the synagogue, it's also a big, powerful, functioning synagogue. They did finally pick a new rabbi, and they will be okay. But I think that what the idea of the book was to really look at the family dynamic of the synagogue, and not just at the rabbi search, but at the dynamic of sort of clergy and congregants and clergy and lay leaders and the executive director, and to really make these people's lives as dramatic as they feel to them sometimes.
It is a dramatic situation inherently, isn't it?
See, I see it that way. I guess I didn't think of it that way until I was in the Minyan, and all of a sudden everything in the synagogue seemed dramatic. But the truth is...
Well, you know, we're Jewish. It's supposed to be dramatic.
When you have so much at stake, I mean, you have the education of young people, you have every positive and negative rite of passage lives within the synagogue. You know, everything that happens there is dramatic. And when you sit with the rabbi and you see what he or she does in any given day, the number of, you know, best news in the world and worst news in the world they hear from hundreds of different people, and, you know, different difficult personnel choices, and of course these difficult problems that there are no solutions to, the people who are diagnosed with, you know, incurable diseases, and it is amazingly dramatic. The synagogue, I think that in a way we have never appreciated how dramatic the day-to-day life is of our congregation. And, you know, I was lucky to be able to, you know, turn to this as a subject for my writing, and I found it endlessly interesting. It was never a dull moment.
Stephen, you wrote, "You never forget your first rabbi," and I think that's true. I don't think anybody will forget the book, The New Rabbi, which is available now from Bantam in paperback. I want to thank Stephen Fried for a great visit here on Too Jewish.
Thanks very much for having me.
Thank you. When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest and have a final musical play out.
The greatest Hanukkah on earth is coming to Temple Emmanuel Sunday, December 14th at 4:30 p.m. Join Temple Emmanuel for the largest, most spectacular, and most enjoyable Hanukkah celebration of all, featuring a wonderful array of music, theater, dance, stories, and magic. Hanukkah comes to life at the Temple's 5th Annual Festival of Lights. Sing and celebrate Hanukkah with us. Begin by helping light the giant outdoor menorah on Country Club Road at 4:30 p.m. And then rejoice with the Avanim Rock Band, Temple Emmanuel Youth and Teen Choir, our string quartet, Rabbi Sam Cohen and David Freeland, and an array of great performers. Bring a menorah and two candles as we light up the night in a gorgeous finale that will make this your most memorable Hanukkah ever. This Hanukkah event is open to all, and there's no charge for the show. Come join the fun at the temple. If you want to join us for a great traditional brisket and latke dinner afterwards, call the temple at 327-4501 and make a reservation with your credit card. Sunday, December 14th, beginning at 4:30 p.m., it's the greatest Hanukkah on earth at Temple Emmanuel. Thank you for joining us this morning on Too Jewish with Rabbi Sam Cohen and friends. You can contact us at 327-4501 or at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com. Come back next Sunday at 10 right here on 990 AM KTKT.
Thanks for being here. Join us next week when our guest will be archaeologist and Bible commentator Dr. Carol Myers, talking about women in the Hebrew Bible. Our playout this morning is another pre-Hanukkah piece from Safam, Al Hanisim. We give thanks for the wonders and miracles you create for us, God. My friends, have a good morning and a Shavua Tov, a week, we pray, of peace.
Bayamim ha'hem.
The preceding program was produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.